From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coal was supposed to be the engine of the Industrial Revolution, not the Internet Revolution. But, writes Jeff Goodell, the rise of the Internet has only increased the industry's power and influence. He says we may not like to admit it, but our shiny white iPod economy is propped up by dirty black rocks. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Goodell about his book, Big Coal, The Dirty Secret Behind America's Energy Future. Also, why the good, the bad, and the ugly should not be dismissed as a spaghetti western. John Powers reviews a new DVD box set of Sergio Leone films. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Many Americans think coal went out with corsets and top hats. But in truth, the U.S. is more dependent on coal today than ever before. Not to warm our hearths, but to generate electric power. So writes Jeff Goodell in his book, Big Coal, The Dirty Secret Behind America's Energy Future. It recently came out in paperback. Coal can help make us less dependent on Middle East oil, but it comes with a price, gas emissions that contribute to global warming. Goodell writes all about coal and the coal lobby, including how the industry helped George W. Bush win the 2000 election. The Senate has been debating the energy bill, and this week it rejected two proposals that would have expanded the production of liquid fuel made from coal. But this week the coal industry also got a boost from the Senate Finance Committee, which approved $28 billion in tax breaks to underwrite renewable fuels and clean coal technology. Jeff Goodell, welcome to Fresh Air. As you point out, coal seems like the fuel that powered the Industrial Revolution, not the era of the Internet Revolution. Yet, you say the rise of the Internet has increased the coal industry's power and influence. How?
Well, one of the big trends that's happening in energy in America is the increasing dependence upon electricity for a lot of things. We all know that through our use of cell phones and our email and the internet and the radio and television. And so electricity is becoming more and more central to how our economy runs. And along with that goes the question of where you get that electricity from. And in America, most people don't know it, but half the electricity comes from burning coal.
About how much coal do we burn a year for electricity?
A little over a billion tons, works out to about 20 pounds per person per day for every man, woman, and child in America.
You describe America as the Saudi Arabia of coal. What do you mean?
Well, we have tremendous reserves of coal in America. We're used to thinking of Saudi Arabia and the political power and economic power that comes with their large oil reserves. And actually, that phrase is a phrase that the coal industry likes to use because it suggests the kind of economic power and size of the reserves that we have in America. The United States does have more coal than any other nation.
Now, the coal industry wants to head in the direction of coal to liquid fuel so that coal could be used, for instance, to power automobiles. Tell us more about what coal to liquid fuel is.
Well, it's a very old technology that was actually pioneered by the Nazis during World War II when Hitler was running out of easy access to oil, and some of his engineers figured out a way to turn coal into into diesel fuel, and that technology has kind of languished ever since. Partly because oil has been so cheap. It's been commercialized and used a little bit in countries like South Africa, where they've had difficulty because of the embargoes and things getting oil. But now that oil is getting expensive and we're looking for replacements for oil and energy independence has become such a kind of political slogan, there's a lot of renewed interest now in trying to displace some foreign oil with domestic coal.
So the advantages of coal to liquid fuel is that it would decrease our dependence on oil from the Middle East. Does it work as well?
Well, first of all, that's the theory, that it would decrease our dependence on oil from the Middle East. One of the big problems with this idea is it's very expensive, very difficult to scale up. And the other thing is that, and it's very important to make this clear, that we can't make gasoline out of coal. We can make diesel fuel, which is not quite obviously the same thing. But there are a lot of problems with going along with this coal to liquid program. Not the least that it's very expensive, and that the if we want to take global warming seriously and doing something about cutting carbon dioxide emissions, this coal to liquids is a real disaster because it's essentially double the amount of carbon dioxide as using conventional gasoline.
So even if this coal to liquid fuel did succeed in reducing our dependence on oil from the Middle East, it would increase our problem with global warming.
Yes, and not only that, it would also increase the problem of the devastation that's happening in Appalachia from these enormous mountaintop removal mines that are really kind of leveling large swaths of southern Appalachia. And if we're going to boost up our coal consumption in America, we can essentially write off that region of the country as a sort of industrial wasteland.
Both the House and the Senate are looking at energy bills. And this week in the Senate, two amendments about coal to liquid fuel were voted down. Just tell us briefly what those amendments were.
Well, one of the amendments was tried to provide about $10 billion in various subsidies and loan guarantees to get some of these plants built, as well as guarantee a billion gallons or so of purchase each year of these coal-to-liquid fuels by the military. The military is interested in these fuels because they see it as a sort of backup in case of they have trouble with, imported oil and scarcity of oil. So that was one amendment. The other amendment was a similar one, except that it didn't have the military subsidies, and it called for a burying and sequestering of the carbon dioxide of these coal plants. It essentially said if you want to build these plants, you have to figure out a way to deal with the carbon dioxide that's coming out of them so we don't accelerate the already accelerating problem of global warming.
Why were these two amendments voted down?
Well, the environmental organizations, first of all, went on the warpath about it precisely because of the carbon dioxide emission problem, and also because these plants are consume a lot of water. So about 4 barrels of water for every barrel of liquid fuel, and especially in places like the West, in Montana and Wyoming, where they're very interested in this technology, that's a really bad deal. So the environmentalists really, really went after it. And so did a lot of Democrats who are not in big coal states. I think for the environmental movement, it was a real line in the sand drawn on this.
So what does this mean about the future of coal to liquid fuel?
Well, that's hard to say. I think the Washington is under tremendous political pressure to do something about gas prices, to pretend that at least for as long as possible, if oil prices start to go up, there are easy substitutes. You're seeing pressure on all kinds of so-called alternative fuels, the tar sands in Canada and renewed interest in shale in the Rocky Mountains. So the political pressure for, to do something about gas prices sort of trumps the political will to do something about global warming. So I think this beast is going to rise again.
How is the coal industry promoting coal to liquid fuel?
Well, they're saying, don't worry about we don't have to deal with Iraq. We have all this coal in America. Senator Byrd, I think the other day in the on the Senate floor, said we have these diamonds beneath our feet, and they're basically promoting it as a no-brainer. Why don't we just do this? We have the technology to do it, and we have the coal, and so let's get on with it. And for them, it's a big boost because they are very concerned about the future of their industry. Coal is the most carbon-intensive fuel. It's really not compatible with a world that takes global warming seriously. Even though there are a lot of coal-burning electric power plants planned, it's harder and harder to permit them. And they really want to get into America's gas tank. And this is the way to do it.
My guest is Jeff Goodell, author of the book Big Coal. He's also a contributing editor for Rolling Stone and a frequent contributor to the New York Times Magazine. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Jeff Goodell. He's the author of the book Big Coal, which recently came out in paperback. And he is a contributing editor to Rolling Stone and a frequent contributor to the New York Times Magazine. How would you describe the coal lobby?
Big and powerful. I mean, what's interesting about the coal lobby is, first of all, as most people know, we've been burning coal in America for 150 years. So it's been around a long time. And so there's a lot of history that goes back between the political connections between the industry and Washington. The second thing that's important to note is that it's not just the coal mining companies and the West Virginia and the places that, that people who know about coal, you know, kind of associate it with it immediately. It's also the coal-burning electric power plants and electric power companies who are very politically influential. And of course, no politician wants to deal with the idea of a blackout or anything like that. And so they don't want to mess with these companies. And third, and very important sort of wedge in this is the railroads. The railroads, especially the big Western railroads like Union Pacific and Burlington Northern, make a very large percent of their profits by hauling coal from Wyoming, which is now the sort of boom town for coal in America, across to the east, to the Mississippi River Valley and beyond. And they really, really want to keep this coal thing happening as long as they can. And they're, of course, America's original monopoly, and they've got a lot of power there, too. So when you combine these three elements, it's a very formidable force.
Has the coal industry had connections to the Bush administration?
Well, I think that's, yeah, quite clear. I mean, I think that there's voluminous records about that. Companies like Peabody Energy were a very large contributor to the Republican Party and to the Bush administration.
They're the largest coal company in America?
They are. They're the largest coal company in America. And I think they may, in fact, be the largest coal company in the world now. They've been expanding radically. You know, we have a vice president who is from Wyoming, which is rapidly becoming, the epicenter for the coal industry in America. And so he's, you know, very connected with this industry. And you have large southeastern utilities like the Southern Company who are notoriously well-connected with the administration, large political donors, and have had a big influence on the administration from the very beginning. And in addition, you know, it was very clear in 2000, after the 2000 presidential election, President Bush made it very explicit that he credited West Virginia, which had not gone Republican in, I don't know, more than 20 years, which went Republican in the 2000 race, largely because of the coal industry getting the miners and things to work hard for his campaign. He credited West Virginia with giving him the race, and so he had a real debt to big coal.
Yeah, you write in your book that the coal industry very much wanted to defeat Al Gore because of Gore's emphasis on global warming.
To be quite blunt about it, Gore is the embodiment of evil to them. I mean, there's no one on the planet that they would fight harder to keep out of office than Al Gore, because, of course, Al Gore has been talking seriously about global warming for a long time, and anyone who talks seriously about global warming is no friend of coal.
If the coal industry helped the Bush-Cheney team get elected, did they return the favor?
Well, I think they did. I think you saw a number of regulatory reversals and other things that have been well chronicled in the media. I mean, the clearest one was in 2000, candidate Bush made a pledge that if elected, he would put restrictions on greenhouse gas emissions, on carbon dioxide emissions. that was something that he said in order to kind of help get some of the suburban and environmental vote away from Gore. And 6 weeks after he was elected, he basically said, oh, well, that was just a campaign promise. That's not really going to happen. And that was the first in a long line of things. There was another infamous fight over old, dirty coal plants and whether they should be allowed to update them and modernize them without putting new pollution controls on them. And the industry got its way on that. There was rollbacks on regulations on large-scale mountaintop removal mining in West Virginia that allowed these big mines to fill in large creeks and do a lot of environmental damage that they were not allowed to do earlier. So I think that it's really hard for me to think of any initiative that's come down in the 7 years or so of the Bush administration that coal hasn't liked.
What role did the coal industry play in Vice President Cheney's energy policy group that met early in the first part of the Bush administration and was very secretive? They were very secretive about even who was in the group.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, a question that, you know, I think history is going to have to answer. I looked into that a lot, and you know, it's not been a lot that's been able to come out about that. And it's clear that some of the big coal companies like Peabody were part of the task force. But, you know, exactly what role they played and how that program was laid out and the forces that went into shaping it is something that a lot of journalists have been trying to look at, and really no one's got a good answer to. But it was pretty clear in the task force recommendations. I mean, it was a big endorsement of burning and mining more fossil fuels, especially coal.
The president and the vice president have worked in the oil industry, so we think of them as being very, you know, as oil men. So it's almost surprising to me to hear that they're connected to the coal industry, because I see coal and oil as being competitive. Could you discuss that a little bit?
Well, that's true, but the interesting thing is that coal and oil really are not competitive. They are separate, which most people don't understand. They you know, coal is basically used exclusively right now in America to generate electricity. And oil is used for a variety of purposes, mostly, of course, transportation and filling up our cars with, you know, to make the gas we fill up our cars with. But there's really no overlap. We don't use oil for electricity generation. And unless this coal to liquids program gets going, we don't use coal in our gas tanks. So they are separate fuel sources, and they don't really compete much in America. And I think that it's true that the administration, you know, does come out of the oil industry, but there's a lot of camaraderie in the fossil fuel industry altogether. And one of the, you know, themes that unites them is the idea that, you know, if we need more energy, what we do is we dig more or drill more or find more, and we keep burning, and we don't inhibit, you know, do anything to inhibit consumption, and we don't try to say anything to Americans that they might have to change their lives because electricity and gas and oil prices are rising.
Now, we've talked a little bit about Bush administration connections to the coal industry. What about Democrats who are connected to the coal industry?
Well, I mean, you know, there's certainly plenty of those also. I mean, coal, the political influence of coal, although it does split on party lines to some degree, it's also quite regional. I mean, you know, there's no bigger booster of coal than Senator Byrd from West Virginia. And he's been very articulate about what coal has done for, or what he says coal has done for West Virginia. And, you know, he's, as I mentioned earlier, has played a role in this coal to liquids debate. So you basically see, you know, politicians who are from coal states boosting coal. It's very hard to get away from it. I think that that's one of the real things to watch and a real challenge right now for Barack Obama as he runs, because he's been playing both sides of this, supporting limits on greenhouse gas emissions, and then at the same time promoting coal to liquids which are really contradictory goals and contradictory policies, although he has backed off his endorsement of coal to liquids lately. But it's really tricky because if you want to get elected to a national office in America, it's very hard to go against coal because you think of the big states that are important on election night and, you know, Ohio, Pennsylvania, West Virginia, Illinois, all these states, these states that are the swing states in many in the national elections, are all big coal states, and so you get a lot of people playing nice to coal.
Now, I hadn't, until reading your book, I really hadn't thought of Wyoming as a big coal state, but you say Wyoming now describes itself as the energy capital because it has so much coal. What kind of coal is it? What makes Wyoming different from other coal states?
Well, there's a number of things. The first and most important one is that unlike in West Virginia and in Appalachia, where the coal is, you know, basically under mountains, where they have to either, historically, where they either tunneled for it in seams of coal that are 6 or 7 feet thick. In Wyoming, you have these enormous coal beds that are 60 or 70 feet thick and just below the surface, a couple of hundred feet, if that, below the surface. And it kind of stretches out like this giant, you know, layer cake under the prairie. And it's a real different operation than it is in Appalachia because, unlike in Appalachia, where when they do these big strip mining and things, you have, you know, towns that are buried and people that are impacted and flooding and all kinds of problems, not to mention the destruction of the of these ancient forests there. In Wyoming, you basically have prairie, and you know, I spent a lot of time out there, and you know, there's nobody living there, and you know, it's really hard to have any. The sort of environmental problems, there aren't any, really. I mean, there's problems with water and a few things, but really it's minor. And so it's very cheap to get out of the ground because of this. And it also has a lower sulfur content in it. Sulfur is what causes sulfur dioxide pollution, one of the main pollutants that causes acid rain and smog. And so electric power companies like this Wyoming coal because it's cheap and because they can burn it instead of spending $100 million on a scrubber to put on their power plant to take the sulfur dioxide out. They can just burn Wyoming coal, and it will allow them to meet the federal air requirements for those power plants. Unfortunately, the real problem with Wyoming coal is it has a lower heat content, so that means that you have to burn more of it to get the same amount of to generate the same amount of electricity, which means more carbon dioxide emissions, which means more greenhouse gases and more global warming.
Jeff Goodell is the author of Big Coal, The Dirty Secret Behind America's Energy Future. It recently came out in paperback. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from American Express, whose special edition CD, Instant Karma, the Amnesty International Campaign to Save Darfur, is at instantkarma.org/imagine. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at macfound.org. And from the Pew Charitable Trusts, helping states protect public safety, hold offenders accountable, and control the cost of corrections. At pewpublicsafety.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, how clean is clean coal? We continue our conversation with Jeff Goodell, author of the book Big Coal, and John Powers reviews a new 8-DVD Sergio Leone box set containing 4 films and lots of extras.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Jeff Goodell, the author of the book Big Coal, The Dirty Secret Behind America's Energy Future. Goodell is a contributing editor for Rolling Stone and a frequent contributor to the New York Times Magazine. When we left off, we were talking about how Wyoming has become a big coal state. So what impact has this growing popularity of Wyoming coal had on, for instance, other coal states like in Appalachia?
It's been devastating for them. I mean, one of the reasons why Senator Byrd and others, West Virginia and Appalachian politicians, are pushing so hard for this coal to liquid is because they're really seeing a decline in production in Appalachia. You know, they've been mining coal there for 130 years or more, and all of the simple, easy-to-get coal is gone. And the coal that's left is more difficult to get, thinner seams, and more expensive, and especially when you're competing with this coal that you can basically dig out with a spoon in Wyoming, Appalachia is really in a tough spot. And so you have them moving to these huge, large-scale mountaintop removal strip mines that, you know, blow up the tops of mountains simply because it's the only way they can compete with Wyoming. Otherwise, you know, it's just too expensive.
What are some of the differences between, like, the newer coal plants and the older ones? Are the newer ones cleaner? Have we made a lot of progress on that front?
Well, I mean, I hesitate to even use the phrase clean coal because it's a phrase that gets batted around a lot, and it really is one of those focus group phrases that, you know, like fat-free donuts or something, that really doesn't mean much. I mean, but it certainly is true that a new coal plant built today is much cleaner when you look at traditional pollutants like sulfur dioxide and nitrogen oxides, which are the two main causes of smog, and the two things that we were really concerned about in the 70s. And they've made real progress cutting emissions 60-70% on new coal plants. The problem is that the thing that we really care about today, which is carbon dioxide emissions, there's no progress, and there's not a lot of hope for any progress in the near future. And so if you judge it from a 1970s point of view, yes, they're cleaner. If you judge it from what we care about today, you know, it's no different.
Well, what about mercury? How much mercury is released from coal-burning plants?
Certainly the number one emitter of mercury into the environment in the world. The U.S. plants emit about 48 tons of mercury a year, and that gets dropped often around the coal plant itself. About a third of that mercury falls within the vicinity of the coal plants. So you get these hot spots around the coal plants. And it varies tremendously depending on the region of the country, the amount of water that's around. The mercury gets into water and is transformed into methyl mercury and then is eaten, taken up by the fish, and builds up in the fish, and that's why we have fish consumption warnings in just about every state in the country now because of this mercury from coal plants.
You write that the coal industry has waged a campaign to downplay the effects of mercury from coal power plants.
Yeah, I mean, it's the same kind of, essentially the same campaign that they waged in the 70s on other pollutants, too, you know, to say that, first, that, you know, it's not our coal plants, it's the coal plants from China or something like that that's bringing the mercury. And then the second argument is always, well, okay, yeah, there's mercury coming out, but it's too hard and too expensive to get it out. So, you know, you really can't pass any tough regulations on it because we just don't know how to get it out of the stack. But now that mercury regulations have been passed, they do know how to do it, and new power plants are going to be much better at that than the older ones.
You write that health researchers are focusing now on small particles known as ultrafines that are released by burning coal. What have they learned about these ultrafines?
Well, see, this is really a fascinating thing because initially when they started looking at air pollution, you know, there was all this stuff coming out of the stacks and these big pieces of soot and it was raining down on everybody. And, you know, the classic kind of images of pollution that people probably have seen in, you know, pictures of London or maybe lived through in Pennsylvania and other places that were really heavily polluted. So they started cleaning up the plants, and they started cleaning up the large particles of soot and of this particulate matter. And that was seemed to be a good thing, and that was progress, and everybody was happy about it. But researchers are now seeing that the removal of these larger particles has had the perverse effect of increasing these tiny nanoparticles, because the big particles used to act like Velcro globs for these smaller particles, these nanoparticles, to glom onto. And so you have these tiny nanoparticles that are floating around. And because coal has lots of stuff in it besides just carbon, like mercury and arsenic and a lot of other stuff, when it burns, that those heavy metals essentially melt and glom onto these little particles. And these little particles are so small that they defeat all of the your body's natural defenses against particle matter. If you try to breathe in a big hunk of soot, it gets blocked in your nose or somewhere in your throat or in your lungs, and it doesn't get absorbed into your bloodstream. These nanoparticles are so small that they defeat all of these natural defenses your body has, and they go essentially right into your bloodstream. And so they're now really looking into the fact that these nanoparticles are essentially carriers for these heavy metals that they know are toxic and are, you know, transporting them into our bodies. There are researchers looking into the impacts on our brains and other things. And this is really still new, really cutting-edge stuff.
So these nanoparticles, would you say, are about the size of a microorganism like a bacterium, that they import with them heavy metals?
Yes. I mean, they're much smaller than actually bacterium even. But yes, they do carry heavy metals with them. As I said, they melt in the combustion process, and then they glom onto these little particles, similar to the way clouds are formed by water droplets glomming onto to little particulate matter and causing, you know, essentially a raindrop or cloud nucleus. The same kind of a principle happening on these nanoparticles.
My guest is Jeff Goodell, author of the book Big Coal. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Jeff Goodell. He's the author of the book Big Coal, which has recently been published in paperback. Now, as part of your research for this book, you visited coal mines in the United States, and you also went to China. On your visits to mines in the United States, you wrote, "I felt like I had stumbled into the gritty underbelly of modern life, the dark, dirty place where the real work is done and the real deals are cut." Tell us about some of the things you saw in coal mining territory that took you by surprise.
Well, the first thing that took me by surprise was, you know, simply the fact that this is how we generate electricity at all. I mean, I grew up in Silicon Valley and was used to celebrating the wonders of electrons and never thought about where they came from. And then I, you know, started exploring this sort of underworld and was just, you know, simply shocked by the fact that we burn rocks essentially the same way we've been doing for 150 years to generate all this electricity. But, you know, when one of the most profound and still kind of haunting part of the research I did for this book was going into these mines with these coal miners. And I need to make it very clear that my criticisms of the coal industry have nothing to do with the people who work in the mines and at the power plants and things. These are amazing men. And being down in a mine is like nothing I've ever done before. The kind of camaraderie that's built up down there and you know, a lot of guys, and it's mostly men who work in these mines, the underground mines, a lot of them hate the work, and they do it because they don't want to, you know, stock yo-yos at Walmart, which is in many parts of coal country the only real options. And they don't like the danger and the hard work, but there are a lot of them who really love it and have coal mining in their blood, And I went down in there underground with a number of these guys, and they're just the most extraordinary men, and they can hear a creak in the ground and tell you if, you know, what that means. And one of them described it to me as every day going underground and wrestling with Mother Nature. And for him, it was just a total thrill every day. So I developed profound respect for these men who were down there, you know, laboring in the darkness so that we can carry around our iPods.
You mentioned your iPods. What's the connection between coal and an iPod?
Well, because, you know, the iPods, you know, it's this, they're just a symbol of this sort of high-tech economy that is runs on electrons. And where do those electrons come from? They come essentially from burning coal. And so we don't think about it, but there's a direct link. Without coal, there is no iPod, there is no iTunes, there is no Apple, there is no iPhone, there is no internet.
And when you mention iPhones, like iPods, for instance, you mean about like charging them? Like we have to charge them before we can be wireless.
Right.
Okay. Tell us a little bit about what you saw when you actually went down in a coal mine.
Well, when I went down into coal mine, you see darkness. You see men sweating. You hear, the loud noise of machinery. It is unlike any other experience I've ever had. Just the absolute darkness, the absolute sense that you are. It's kind of a cliche to compare it to, you know, this sort of hell-like, you know, place, is underworld, but it really is, you know. I mean, you know, you can't help thinking about things like that, that just the blackness of the faces. But what I really, really felt was the human bond of the people who were working under there. It was really profound, and it is extraordinarily dangerous, and these men take incredible care of each other. And the kind of things they do under there and the dangers they put themselves in order to get a ton of coal out of the ground are just mind-boggling. And so every time I came out of a coal mine, I just, you know, was just full of respect for these guys. And it was really a profound experience for me.
Now, you went to China to look at coal there, and you found coal, like visible chunks of coal all over the place. Tell us what you saw.
Well, it was really stunning to me because, you know, in America, it's very easy to go through your life without knowing that we burn any coal at all. It's burned in, you know, big power plants that are usually a long way from population centers, and the electricity is brought into our houses by wire. And basically, you can, you know, easily live your life and never see a chunk of coal in America. As soon as you step off the plane in China, it is everywhere. You know, the soot is coming out of the sky. It's stacked up in bricks behind people's houses. The power plants are still in the middle of town in Beijing, although they're beginning to move them out now because of the upcoming Olympics. But, you know, you still have what they call these sort of central heating districts where they'll have one modest-sized power plant and heating plant for, you know, a couple of apartment buildings. So you have this brick smokestack in the middle of this neighborhood with, you know, sooty smoke pouring out of it. And you have people walking around with handkerchiefs over their faces so they don't breathe the soot. And as shocking and everything as all that is, I found it kind of refreshing in the sense that there was no secret about it. There was no one denied. No one tried to pretend that coal was clean, and no one tried to pretend that this wasn't what's powering the Chinese economy, unlike in America, where, you know, it really is kind of a secret.
Are health problems as a result of coal more visible in China?
Oh, yeah. I mean, especially because they still burn coal, you know, in their homes for cooking and for heating, and especially in the poor sections of China. I went to the far west of China, out to the sort of Silk Road area, where is one of the poorest parts of regions in China. I mean, you know, that's the most deadly for air pollution, particulate air pollution. So, you know, I think that the World Health Organization estimates over 300,000 people a year dying from outdoor particulate air pollution, which is essentially coal. And then you have the deaths in the coal mines. I mean, the coal mining in China is still a very kind of backyard operation, very little regulation. The official numbers are 6,000 people a year dying in the mines, but the unofficial numbers are twice that.
Now, you said that the coal industry in the United States is facing a demographic nightmare. What's the nightmare?
The nightmare is that coal miners are getting old, and you know, I think the average age of a coal miner in America today is, you know, mid-50s, and no one has gone into the coal industry for a generation. You know, young people don't want to go underground. They don't want to get dirty that way. It's every coal miner I know, and I'm and this is not this is without exception. Every coal miner I've talked to has said to me, "My kid is not. I'm doing this, but my kid is not doing this. I don't care if he works at a prison. I don't care if he, you know, goes to the military. I don't, you know, whatever. He is not working in a coal mine." So you have this kind of generational, you know, sort of laying down of the law coming down too, and so it's a real challenge, because if you really are going to ramp up coal, then you know, you're going to basically have to pay people a lot more to bring them in. And in parts of Appalachia, there's even been talk about bringing in miners from China or from South America, which has caused a real firestorm, even when the topic is brought up in the most quiet way.
Why has that caused a firestorm?
Well, because it's, you know, it's seen as taking jobs. You know, one of the coal's great selling points is that it's, you know, the all-American fuel. You know, it's mined here in America by proud American coal miners, and it's our native rock and that. And when you have the idea of bringing in cheap immigrant labor to do this work, it really causes a lot of tension in Appalachia, where they, you know, these jobs are, especially if they're going to start paying more, people will take them.
How has the research you've done for your coal book affected how you personally consume energy? Has it made a difference?
Yes, and I think one of the reasons I wrote this book was because out of this sort of shock, you know, because I had gone through, you know, the first 40 years of my life or 38 years of my life, you know, never thinking about any of this, and then to go down to West Virginia and begin to look into this and see where all this came from, it really rocked me. And so now, you know, I can't walk my dog in my neighborhood and see a spotlight on a tree outside without thinking about coal. You know, I've done all the things that we all do, or the people who are conscious of this are doing now, like changing your light bulbs from incandescents to compact fluorescents and buying Energy Star appliances. But you know, what I bump up against, and what many people bump up against, is there's only, you know, so much that you personally can do, and it really needs large government action to really deal with this. Because I can buy, you know, green power, but if they're still building coal plants in Wyoming and things, it's not going to solve the problem of global warming unless we have not only a national policies but a global policy on it.
Well, Jeff Goodell, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Jeff Goodell is the author of Big Coal, The Dirty Secret Behind America's Energy Future. It recently came out in paperback. Coming up, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly for a Fistful of Dollars, plus two more Sergio Leone movies and lots of extras. John Powers reviews an 8-DVD Leone box set. This is Fresh Air. The late Italian film director Sergio Leone is best known for his westerns and is one of the most influential modern filmmakers, inspiring everybody from Martin Scorsese to John Woo. Quentin Tarantino called Leone's film The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly the best directed movie of all time. It's included in a new 8-disc DVD set, the Sergio Leone Anthology. It contains 4 feature films and a huge array of extras about Leone's career. Our critic at large, John Power, says it's well worth having, and he admits his perceptions of Leone have changed over the years.
When I was growing up, we were constantly going to drive-in movies. I saw scores of things there, from Hercules epics with Steve Reeves to Michelangelo Antonioni's Blow Up, which wasn't exactly made to be watched in a car. Looking back, I realized that my most thrilling moments at the drive-in came from the 3 so-called spaghetti westerns that made Clint Eastwood an international star. A Fistful of Dollars, For a Few Dollars More, and especially The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. Here were movies bold enough to hold their own against squawky speakers, honking wiseacres, and the starry Midwestern sky. All 3 were made by Sergio Leone, and they've been brought together in the Sergio Leone Anthology. This indispensable set features not only beautifully restored versions of these movies, but a full-length version of a terrific one called Duck, You Sucker, that played here in butchered form. The dullest of the 4 is A Fistful of Dollars from 1964, and it just happens to be a landmark. Not only did it define Eastwood's persona, the impassively ruthless man with no name who comes decked out in a poncho and surgically implanted cheroot, it took popular filmmaking to a then-scandalous new level of violence and moral darkness. Just as the movie didn't look like a usual Western, it was shot in sunblasted southern Italy, it didn't feel like one either. Here was a Western for an era that no longer took the old codes for granted. The good guys weren't, well, good. Although its sequel, For a Few Dollars More, was clearly a much better film, I still remember being startled by the artistic leap of The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, the first of Leone's great films. This 3-hour epic of greed, set against the backdrop of the American Civil War, is filled with amazing things. Dazzling set pieces, Eli Wallach's hilarious yammering as the ugly, and a theme by Ennio Morricone that has become iconic. It also exudes a powerful sense of waste in all the film's killing. That same humanity shines through Duck, You Sucker, an ambivalent, hugely pleasurable tale of the Mexican Revolution, centering on the unexpected friendship between 2 very different men. Juan is a wholly self-interested Mexican bandito played by Rod Steiger, whose performance is a flamboyant hybrid of a bemused Marlon Brando and Al Pacino doing Scarface. John is an idealistic Irish revolutionary, played by that cool lizard James Coburn, he of the long leathery face and teeth the length of piano keys. Here, John tries to enlist Juan into serving the revolution.
What's up?
It's a map. It's your country you're lying all over there.
Not my country. My country is me and my family.
Well, your country's also Huerta, and the governor, and the landlords, and Gunther Ruiz and his locusts. And this little revolution we're having here.
Revolution? Revolution, please don't try to tell me about revolution. I know all about the revolutions and how they start. The people that read the books, they go to the people that don't read the books. They put people and they say, ho, the time has come to have a chance,
huh?
Shh, 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 shh. I know what I'm talking about when I'm talking about the revolutions.
The people who read the books go to the people who can't read the books, the poor people, and say, we have to have a change, so the poor people make the change, huh?
And then the people who read the books, they all sit around the big polished tables, and they talk and talk and talk and eat and eat and eat, huh? But what has happened to the poor people? They're dead! That's your revolution.
40 years ago, Leone was reckoned obviously inferior to such Italian giants as Fellini, Antonioni, and Bertolucci. Next to them, he was the man with no name. But his reputation has grown since then, partly thanks to 2 brilliant films not collected here, Once Upon a Time in the West and Once Upon a Time in America. But Leone's ascent is also inseparable from the fact that his movies have aged extremely well. His work feels timeless, It doesn't so much take place in the actual West as in a foreign director's reverie on images and ideas of the West that Leone got from old movies. He mythologizes something that was already mythic. He turns it operatic. His Westerns really are horse operas, with oversized characters, hyperbolic showdowns, and the cinematic equivalent of bravura arias, like the great set piece in The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, when Eastwood first turns Wallach into the sheriff for the bounty, then shoots the hangman's rope to let him escape. This mythic quality is amplified by Leone's trademark style, those indelible widescreen shots of landscapes, water drips, and especially faces, those big eyes, as they were known, that fill the whole screen. His images explode. They have a pop art vividness, and they come accompanied by Morricone's exhilarating music, which ranges from the witty to the achingly nostalgic. You see, for all his storytelling panache, Leone was also a poet of loss, of the vanished past. No doubt my own nostalgia helps explain why I like these particular movies so very much. Yet seeing them again on DVD, I was reminded just how enjoyable they actually are, and how revealing about how our perceptions change. Watching them in order, from A Fistful of Dollars to Duck, You Sucker, you get a roadmap of a filmmaker's growth. You watch Leone get better, sharper, deeper, more complicated. And you realize that, once upon a time in Italy, a guy who started out making things labeled spaghetti westerns was actually on his way to creating art.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue magazine. He reviewed the Sergio Leone anthology. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of The Histories of Herodotus, in stores and online at bn.com. From the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, supporting health insurance coverage for all America's children, on the web at covertheuninsured.org. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers, audible.com/freshair. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Meg, look at this place.
Well, this place is like a mansion. It's
like a mansion. The White Stripes have a new album called Icky Thump. On the next Fresh Air, we hear from Jack and Meg White. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air. What kind of-